Sourcing Matters Podcast. This is your host, Aaron Niederhummen, sharing stories of our food.
And welcome back to Sourcing Matters. This is your host, Aaron Niederhummen. Today, we got a great co-host joining again today. It's Jennifer Hashley. Hey, Jennifer, how you doing?
I'm great, Aaron. How are you doing?
Hey, it's always great to have you partake in the show. You bring such a wealth of knowledge, and I enjoy chatting with you. So thanks so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Of course. So, Jennifer, just a quick bit about your background so our audience knows that I'm not just playing you up here, that you actually have this incredible clout and background. So, through the New Entry Sustainable Farming Project and Pete and Jen's Backyard Birds, Jennifer Hashley is a well-known name in sustainable farming in the Northeast. Spawned out of the Tufts Friedman School of Nutrition, the New Entry program is one of the first initiatives nationwide to help immigrants and refugees develop commercial farming opportunities. Jennifer's goal is to help new farmers excel in the field, and New Entry gives them the tools that they need to do that. It's a revolutionary program that looks at sustainable and regenerative farming as jobs creation and economic growth for regions that often need a stimulus. Additionally, Jennifer and her husband Pete run the diversified pasture-based livestock operation and Pete and Jen's Backyard Birds, which recently transitioned to a much larger parcel of land at the renowned Codman Community Farm in Lincoln, Massachusetts. Last, Jennifer, I just want to mention that you're also a hands-on creator of a USDA-funded mobile processing facility for poultry, which is actually where we first met many years ago at the New England Meat Festival, which they actually incorporated a meatball as the big event that night. She's an advocate and compelling speaker and writer and contributes to numerous boards pushing the industry in the right direction. In fact, last night we were at one of an event for that she sits on a board called the CARE Project. We had a chance to learn more about what they're up to, and that was quite exciting.
Great. Well, thank you, Aaron. I appreciate that introduction.
Hey, no problem. Hey, let's get into something that's really topical. And I mentioned this to you last night, and I'm excited for this because I've been holding this close to my vest, this conversation, because I've been waiting for this conversation with you and our guest today. And it's a landmark decision that happened in August. So we had 46-year-old Dwayne Johnson, who's not Dwayne Johnson the Rock, but another California-based guy that was awarded $289 million by a California jury for his court case against Monsanto, which is now Bayer, that was directly that they're the maker of the herbicide Roundup. So what was interesting with this is Johnson is a schoolyard groundskeeper in the Bay Area who has repeatedly applied Roundup from 20 to 30 times per year. Johnson is now dying from non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, a type of cancer that impacts 200,000 people or new folks every year in the U.S. Monsanto has had thousands of cases against them, claiming similar impact from this herbicide, but this is the first ever court-awarded damages for a highly controversial chemical, which is now the most used synthetic chemical in the world. Some people say two times the volume of any other chemical used in the world. $250 million of those awarded damages were punitive, meaning that this is a bit of a call to action or maybe a statement that enough is enough, that we kind of maybe actually a bit like the beginning of a citizen's revolt against the U.S. tobacco industry, where common sense finally caught up with common practice. So Bayer, who bought Monsanto earlier this year for $63 billion, is obviously appealing this ruling. But since the Lodestar case, which I had to throw that word in there after that op-ed in New York. It just
right.
It's so topical in itself. Bayer and Monsanto have been hit by another 8,700 cases, mostly by cancer patients, alleging fault and cause for the sterilization agent. Now, you feel badly for Dwayne Johnson, a dad dying of cancer who's suffered these basically daily from these lesions that covered 80% of his body. But we can't feel too badly for Monsanto, right? They're kind of like a big tobacco where these seed companies were and will be amazingly resilient. They'll find that the new global markets or new products that they'll make up for their losses in glyphosate. We're not too worried about that. But I want to say about that is I strongly believe that there are some great folks working for these companies, folks who truly believe their approach is how we're going to feed the world. And instead of wagging the finger at the evil empire, maybe the best route of resistance for us is to express enough truth and value for them for us to show our lodestar light. I could throw it in again. A bit like climate change deniers, these aging breed of folks who believe that input-based and extractive agricultural models is the only way of the future will only prove to be hyperbolic, if not corrupt, as if we push forward with business-as-usual approach and feeding on a shrinking planet. You know, for all of us, this is really something where this stuff is our health through our food, so we all got to own this stuff, right? So what I'm going to throw out there is a bit of point of clarity. That Roundup was designed to do one thing. It is a sterilization agent. It was made for transgenesis seeds. It kills all living matter, whether that's soil or veg associated to it, unless it's been modified to work with those chemicals in the seeds. There's a direct correlation. It's really the biggest concern around GMOs and really impetus for some of the biggest questions about GMOs and the associated name, right, of the evil empire. So when we dump all these sterilization agents and bad chemicals out there and nothing can grow, you know, except for those petrochemical steroids and the seeds induced with that, what do we think is going to happen with that? What do we think is going to happen to our health by eating the crops that come off that stuff if we're sterilizing the soil and then that correlation to our own health? So I'm more stating this as a fact and saying it's kind of leading up to our conversation today, right? We've got an unbelievable guest who's going to be able to share some knowledge, I think, for us in this. And we're going to get under the hood a bit with that. And today we welcome a medical professional who has the chops to make a difference in conventional medicine, conventional agriculture, and conventional wisdom through the impact of soil health on our health. Today we welcome Dr. Daphne Miller. Hey, Daphne, how you doing?
I'm well. Thank you so much for having me here.
Yes, of course. So, Daphne, we had a chance to meet a couple years ago, and I was enthralled by what you had to say. And I know you've been doing quite a bit of research into the correlation of soil health and the microbiome and human health. And I do want to get into that. But let me read, if I could, just a bit about your background so our listening audience gets a feel for who you are and some of the other publications that you've put out there. So Miller is a practicing family physician, an author, and associate clinical professor at the University of California, San Francisco. For the past 15 years, her leadership, advocacy, and research and writing have focused on the connection between food production, ecology, and health. Dr. Daphne Miller founded Whole Family MD, San Francisco's first integrative primary care medical practice in fall of 2001. Her mission was to reclaim the heart of medicine by focusing on her patients rather than the business and the red tape of medical practice. Well, that's very refreshing. That's awesome. Over the ensuing years, the practices have grown, but Dr. Miller has not stayed from her original vision. So when you're not seeing patients or teaching, Dr. Miller writes books and articles related to food, farming, and the environment and health. You have authored two best-selling books, The Jungle Effect, which is the healthiest diets from around the world and why they work and how to make them work for you. And that was in 2008. And then Pharmacology.
That's a mouthful, that one. Yeah.
That's right. And I messed it up. I apologize. And Pharmacology, which is the total health from the ground up, which was in 2013. You have a graduate degree from Brown University and Harvard Medical School. And you have completed your family medicine residency in the NHA-funded primary care research fellowship at the UCSF, University of California, San Francisco. So incredible background, and you have the chops within the medical world and obviously the insight within that correlation of looking at a systems thinking. So with that background, Daphne, could you tell us a bit about what you're doing in 2018 and the projects you're working on now?
Yeah, a number of different things that really all boil down to trying to make our food system healthier from the soil up. really, what I found is that trying to straddle the world of human health and soil health are really fairly complicated because there's an enormous divide between the two. It's both a knowledge divide, a policy divide, and a practice divide. In health, we are starting to care a little bit more about food, and that's a very hopeful thing. But it tends to be very much on the delivery side. So, you know, there's now a nascent kind of food as medicine movement where people are actually thinking, oh, instead of just using pharmaceuticals, there is that opportunity to think about how food can both protect us and even possibly treat us. And that's, you know, a real huge step forward for healthcare and very, very hopeful. There's also kind of a healthy food environment movement within the health or public health side, this idea that it's not just telling people to eat the broccoli or eat the carrots, but that you actually have to make the healthy choice, the easy choice by changing school cafeterias and making sure that the neighborhood stores have healthy foods to purchase and, you know, potentially even bringing community gardens into neighborhoods and just, you know, changing the food environment. And these are really, really hopeful things. And then on the agricultural side, you know, the discussion really is about sustainability and production. And what's shifting there a little bit is the idea that we're not just producing for calories and pounds, but also producing for nutrients per acre or nutrients per pound. But the disconnect between the two is that in healthcare and in public health, we're really not talking about production at all. There's very little discussion about agriculture or the places where our food is grown or how those need to shift and change in order to create these healthy food environments or even produce the food that could be the food as medicine. And until we really connect those dots between the soil and production and our personal health, I don't think we're going to make a very big dent into our epidemic of chronic disease or, you know, the continuously escalating obesity rates the fact that, in fact, we have a very unsustainable food system.
So one question I had for you, Daphne, is how do you see getting the medical community more engaged? I feel like we already know that, you know, basically they have, what, 1 8-hour class requirement in nutrition in all of the 4 years plus of medical school. You know, how do we hope that we can get these, you know, frontline medical doctors more educated around food and ag production and soil health and the whole kind of connection piece?
Absolutely. So that for me, that is one of the questions I'm trying to tackle right now. The other question really is, what can we accomplish by getting them more engaged? And so there's sort of many levels to this, because what's clear is that, people who are working in soil health and agriculture alone need to know where they're pointing the arrow in terms of production in order to be able to change the system. And healthcare, in a way, is sort of the recipient of that. And so healthcare and nutrition, you know, I'm sort of discussing broadly. So on two levels, you know, how do we get them more engaged? And it's, you know, the second question is, to do what? Mm-hmm. And so I've been really in this, very much in sort of a discovery or fact-finding mode in terms of trying to answer that question. And the way I've been doing that is, number one, really starting to look at, you know, take a landscape analysis of every initiative that's happening, not just in the U.S., but kind of internationally, that is trying to connect the dots really between human health and soil health or agriculture. That's one piece, and sort of see what they're working on. The second piece is actually trying to to have a number of knowledge creation activities that, that join health and agriculture. So recently we had a colloquium on soil health and human health here at UC Berkeley. It was a one-day colloquium where we, for each session was on a different topic. One was on farm worker health, another one was on food safety, basically all these issues that straddle soil health and human health. And for each session, we had someone who was either a researcher, policy person, or practitioner from healthcare who was co-presenting with someone from ag and then had a moderated discussion between the two. And that was just from that one day, we realized how groundbreaking it is to really try and moderate these discussions across disciplines, because in fact, we speak totally different languages. We have different metrics. We have different, ways that we sort of interact within our own professions, different cultures. And so trying to create that bridge is actually quite challenging. And then another piece of the knowledge building activity was that we actually had a soil lab for health practitioners where we got them onto a sustainable farm in the Central Valley and had them actually develop ecological literacy around soil health and really understand what soil organic matter was and how the soil gets formed and what are the challenges, the true biological and chemical and mechanical challenges and human resource challenges to growing food in this country, so that they can begin to actually, you know, understand really on a scientific level where our food comes from. So those are the two activities that I'm kind of involved in now. One of them really just understanding what's going on around the world, and the other one really trying to push knowledge creation between the two disciplines.
And are you finding, Daphne, from your landscape assessment here, that you're speaking to these different stakeholders from multidimensional disciplines, are you finding any harmony or consensus, or are you trying to help define that commonality of language? And what are these symposiums bringing to fruition?
Right. And so there has only been one symposium so far. And
okay.
Institute for Soil Health is actually putting on another one in Maryland next month that I will be at. And that one's specifically focused around research. So this is a very nascent activity. It's just super, super new. And in fact, we don't even have a name for this activity yet. We've been proposing that we call it Health from the Soil Up Initiative, you know, as a sort of very good descriptor of what we're trying to do. I'd love both of your opinions on that, by the way.
I like that name.
I do.
I mean, I think we are finally seeing, like, healthcare foundations and others invest in more of these grassroots community-based projects that you were mentioning, healthy stores, community gardens, mobile markets, trying to, expand this healthy food environment. But, yeah, I'm not really clear how much, direct education the frontline healthcare profession has, from the knowledge base of these things or what you're talking about. So I think these education sessions sound great.
Even the investments in the healthy food environments and all of that, we do not have a lot of information about how that changes our production system in this country. And so that's the big gap, honestly. It all feels very good, what we're doing from the culinary medicine and healthy food environment and all of this. But is it actually changing what people are eating in the U.S. and particularly the most vulnerable populations? And more importantly, is it actually shifting what Aaron was referring to, which is, how we are using our agricultural resources in this country? Or is this just all a little bit of a feel-good activity that actually isn't shifting, the large pieces of our production system at all? And, those are really where I think we need to be focusing some of our questions.
Well, it's interesting. This morning I was at Babson College on an entrepreneurship panel, and we were talking about changes in technology and how it's being applied. And one of the things that the other panelist was mentioning is that consumers have a huge power in how we see this technology rolling out across the landscape. And because there's been more education and other things and kind of a backlash against some of these technologies like GMOs and others, she was describing that she felt like the tech sector or the ag development sector is being somewhat thwarted or slowed down because this consumer pressure to be more transparent and understand things is having an impact on how quickly they can roll out, you know, further new technologies that may be useful in the future. And I thought that was an interesting perspective.
So there's so much distrust in the current conventional system that we're kind of going at everything with additional checks and balances to make sure that we're going to get it right to begin with. That's the theory.
That's the theory, right?
Yeah. Okay. Interesting.
Well, that's interesting, and honestly, it's quite hopeful in a way. You know, the question I have, and if any of you have any data on this, I'd be super, super curious. But really, you know, with so much more of an emphasis on creating, you know, healthy food systems within communities, so healthy food outlets and so on, are we seeing a shift in how we're using land? Are there farmers who were doing high input based commodity farming who are actually, you know, starting to shift to a more conservation form of agriculture? Are we seeing, you know, progressively, you know, more no-till, low chemical farming, you know, diversified farming going on big pieces of land here in the U.S. Or is the way that we're growing food and commodities, because most of what is grown is in fact not for humans but for animals and cars in this country. Is that really sort of business as usual, or are we seeing some kind of positive shift there?
What I've seen, at least, and this is, I used to worry, Daphne, if it was all confirmation bias. Like, you can find anything to back up stats, right? I mean, I actually come from the private equity world, which the whole model is built off of. Like, you can back up anything you have a theory on. But what I've found, which I've been surprised by, even some of the conversations we've had on Sourcing Matters, is conventional players that are looking at this almost as a pragmatic, better approach, because just the economic models of conventional agricultural systems can't scale moving forward. The expense is just corrupting and bankrupting many of the farmers. And groups like the Noble Research Institute, who are behind some of the Soil Academy that you were speaking of, that hosting the event next month, are doing ecological marketplaces or ecosystem and environmental services marketplaces around sequestering carbon, around water quality, around soil health as a collective. And then to see groups like General Mills, who are acquiring companies like Annie's and Cascadia Farms, and have launched initiatives like the regenerative scorecarding tools that they've had for their farmers to start moving in this direction. Boy, I think that's very positive signs that it's cracking this nut of the conventional model, which controls a significant portion of production. And obviously, kind of that common vernacular that reaches the consumers of our traditional food system.
And I forget what the exact statistic is. I think, you know, the organic sector is the one that's growing the fastest still year over year. And so I think a lot of these folks that are looking across the supply chain of where is this going to come from?
Yeah,
there's a lot more interest.
It's challenging, and all of the misnomers going out to consumer. If we're confused in the industry, if we're confused on the medical side of things, we're not even confused, but just we don't know that, like you spoke of, Daphne, we don't have a shared language to use amongst ourselves. And we're even changing the game that kind of organic and responsible and sustainable farming is yesterday's news. We're on to regenerative and resilient practices that those often just add more confusion, never mind all of the 200 certifications that consumers see to not know what is right for my food systems. And that is an opportunity. We have to look at it that way, an opportunity for all of us to help define that language. And actually leads me to one of the questions I want to ask you, Daphne. In these discussions you're having in these soil symposium, which I think are fantastic, and I do believe that change agent is going to be us materializing it to ourselves and to our family, what the impact of soil is on us. But one trend that I've seen, at least maybe in the systems thinking approach, is, you know, yes, the health of soil and the direct impact on us is, you know, maybe us progressive in this view are seeing that, or even some people are starting to be coaxed along that direction. But what I've seen, at least maybe on a citizen's awakening of this, is that connection that soil health actually connects with planetary stability. And a lot of these models for better or differentiated or elevated standards in agricultural models, which impact us as consumers and eaters, also have a net positive effect on environmental stability. Was that narrative discussed in your symposiums, or have you looked into that as a way to connect with more consumers and more individuals who care about this?
Absolutely. And I you know, honestly, what I'm starting to realize, Aaron, is that in terms of engaging the healthcare community, that might be a better hook than even the nutrient density issue, you know. So, because it just at this point there is so much panic about the health impact of climate change, you know, and you know, new information that we have about carbon sequestration in the soil and it potentially at least being, you know, a partial solution to excess atmospheric carbon is something that I think is actually resonating with folks. So that's definitely a piece of you know, what we're describing. But what I keep on coming back to is sort of this question of why get healthcare involved? Why get healthcare invested in the entirety of our ag system and you know, caring about things literally from the soil up, trying to change policy from the soil up, trying to direct funds at, you know, agricultural issues and not just what we classically think of as public health issues. And there's a number of reasons why I think it's very important. Number one is so that we can start to ask compelling research questions on how to actually grow food that most benefits humans. Because we really don't have that information. We don't have that information about what agricultural systems are most protective in terms of our lung health or in terms of, you know, preventing our exposure to environmental cancers. We don't have complete information about which systems actually optimize the you know, microbial populations, you know, so that potentially whatever gets transferred to our personal microbiome is the safest possible. We don't have information on how to grow food that is going to have the optimal amount of fiber and nutrient density and so on. And then, of course, that will produce a yield that can feed our, you know, a growing population. So that's one reason to get people from health involved, is so that we really can help tailor agriculture to be health-centered, if that makes sense. Because we don't have those answers right now. The other reason to get healthcare involved is that if you look at just sort of spending, healthcare are the deep pockets in this country. It's where an enormous amount of our GDP is spent. And if we start to actually do the math on the true cost of our food system to health, then in fact, maybe the argument can be made that, you know, many of these billions of dollars that we're spending, you know, treating the end effect of our food system, like, you know, on end-stage diabetes and dialysis and so on, could potentially be better invested early on in the soil to making it so these diseases do not manifest in the first place. And I know that that's a complex calculus to make, but that's another reason to sort of start to link these two systems. And then the third reason is because people in healthcare are actually excellent advocates for changing things once they do get involved. It's, you know, thanks to a lot of interest finally from physicians and other people in health that the emission standards in our country were changed for automobiles, or safety standards are for automobiles. It's, you know, thanks to the buy-in from healthcare that, you know, tobacco laws were changed and so on. So just from that standpoint, we really do need for people in health to weigh in on what foods we are growing in this country and how they are grown. And when I look at the numbers, honestly, like, still, what is it at this point? I think it's, you know, somewhere about 18 to 22% of the croplands in this country are nominally under conservation practices. So, you know, with perennial cover and no till, and at least sort of minimal use of chemicals or appropriate use of chemicals. That leaves 80% of the farmland, this country, that's basically being fairly irresponsibly managed still. And that's massive.
One question I had that you mentioned earlier, you were talking about kind of the concept of sustainable diets. And I think that's, like, I'm really impressed by this continuum of going from, you know, human health all the way back down to the soil health. And the big key piece of this, too, in addition to the three things that you just mentioned, but how do we get people to choose sustainable diets? I mean, that seems like the missing link between, you know, if we do everything we need to do to kind of transition the 80% of the farmland to more sustainable regenerative practices, and we have, you know, human health, you know, if we want to influence human health, there still needs to be that middle part of human behavior, choice, knowledge, all of that. And I feel like the nutrition messaging is so complex, and this, you know, all these different systems that we're talking about that are interrelated, as you mentioned, are so complex. How do we get people to really make healthy choices? I mean, it's one thing to get a prescription or an RX from your doctor to say eat healthier food and to change the diet or the sustainable diet and the environment around us, but how do we really drill in on that?
Yeah, and I think that is a really important piece of this for sure, because at the end of the day, it can work, you know, sort of upstream and change the production system. But this is a little bit of the eternal conversation that we're in, is, you know, what is the most effective way to do this? Is it to educate consumers and have them change their behaviors, and somehow that is going to change the production system? Or is it to change the production system and then have consumers adopt accordingly? Because if you think about it, you know, our absolute addiction to, you know, processed empty carbohydrates is as a result of what we started to produce in the agricultural system, you know, which was basically a response to a need for, you know, wartime calories. And that's when we started to just, you know, produce all the corn, soy, and wheat in massive quantities, which is, you know, basically been since then the raw materials for the highly processed diet that we're eating. So you have to ask, if we actually changed what we were growing, would diets change accordingly? There's certainly right now not a lot of evidence that, you know, educating consumers is really changing the production system at all. And it's certainly no evidence that educating consumers has changed the obesity rates in this country. I mean, the latest NHANES data actually shows that amongst adults, the weight trends are going up, not down, despite all of us, you know, getting much more excited about local food and healthy local food systems.
It's a vicious cycle, there's no doubt, and it is so complex. It's now a global cycle, as well as the food systems become global, and to monocultural practices, and then that correlation to obesity rates by 2025, we're going to have something like 45% of domestic U.S. Citizenship right. being obese. I mean, there's no doubt it's a challenge. And I, going back to your other point of the influence of medical professionals is vast. I mean, you can even connect that to how we use that in free markets to advertise to people, whether it's from the biopharma world or even when we want to talk about natural or value, we still use medical professionals and the influence there. Aside from maybe the mom, the choosy mom select GIF type idea, medical professionals are probably the most powerful groups that are looking at what this means. And even when we first started this conversation to open talking about what nutritional guidelines really mean, and are we actually propagating the wrong language and concepts to begin with? Boy, that just adds to that vicious cycle. And to your point, Daphne, I don't know if we start with doing agricultural models better, or if we use the consumer as the change agent here. The concern, I think, with going on the agricultural side is it takes huge buy-in from people that are very reactionary, whether it's policymakers or maybe even the medical world, that don't have the impetus of change. Whereas the consumer is seeing this impact, and maybe the pendulum has swung so far out of whack that we are going to have drastic change in food system. It's not necessarily food as medicine, but maybe it's going to be preventative healthcare. And maybe that's a transcending a moment for us, is that we look at this and say, that's healthcare for ourselves and for the planet, but maybe that's too aspirational. I'm not sure. And maybe we need baby steps to begin with. And maybe we need things like these court cases against Monsanto to begin. And actually, I want to return back to that, Daphne, of just asking you if we could, from some of your research, glyphosate, you know, obviously has a big, big bad name around the effect on your body and what's happening. Do you have any thoughts that you wanted to add to that comment or comments you want to add to that storyline of how overused glyphosate is and Roundup is in our food system and what that impact could be happening on our microbiome?
There's, you know, the research on glyphosate and the microbiome is so poorly done that, you know, it'd be absolute conjecture, but you know, clearly it acts like pesticides, herbicides act like antibiotics. So one has to assume that what it's doing is not positive for the human microbiome. There were a couple studies that looked at it. Unfortunately, there's been a huge amount of controversy around these studies, and one of them was redacted, and so on. And partly because of the methodologies that were used in the research. And then actually it was republished somewhere else, but issues with it. But, you know, clearly not beneficial. And there is abundant evidence that glyphosate is associated, you know, with a whole variety of cancers, which is why this court case was so easily won.
Yeah.
For me, I really don't focus so much on issues like GMO technology or glyphosate. I really try to not go down those rabbit holes and focus more on the big system that is actually requires those inputs in order to survive. And what's clear is that, you know, high input based, you know, industrial style of agriculture is just not sustainable anymore. And we have so much evidence to support that, you know, going back to that, you know, reports, the IASTD report, and, you know, a whole variety of reports that have been put out by the Food and Agriculture Organization of the UN, and even by the U.S. Department of Agriculture and so on. We know how to grow food in a generally healthy way, both in the U.S. and around the world. There's plenty of evidence of how to do that, both to grow enough food to proportionately match a given population, and also to do it in a way that in some total is positive for the planet. We have that data. We know that. It's just that we're not applying those principles. You know, in terms of getting into the weeds and actually trying to perfect these agricultural systems so that they are optimizing nutrition for given populations and minimizing the use of water and minimizing the use of chemicals and so on. There's, you know, tons more research to be done there. And that's where I'm really calling for this conversation between ag and health. But the general idea of what the principles are of healthy agriculture, we know those, you know, of healthy, productive agriculture.
Well answered. And yes, I mean, I think that's, I understand too. We want to make sure that we don't have the very busy lawyers at Monsanto knocking on our door as well for making claims. But I couldn't agree with you more. I think it's a good approach to walk before we run. Let's not worry about many of these in the weeds or reductionist approach to things. There are many other bigger problems to solve. Let me ask this if I could, and Jennifer, I don't want to jump on your toes. Do you have a follow-up question to that, or?
No, I think that's spot on. I think, yeah, it's, we can go down any rabbit holes we need, whatever technology of the day that it is, but I think it comes back to the systems approach. And I think the conversation I was having this morning is somebody, a student asked, I said, I think my biggest fallacy in agriculture is that organic can't feed the world. Like that's the narrative that we hear, right? Organic's not going to feed the growing, however many billion are going to be on the planet in the next 50 years. And I feel like that's short-sighted response, because as you said, we know how to grow food in responsible ways, and it's been proven many times over. And I think there's just this strong impetus toward technology is going to save it. And I think the right kind of technology applied in a holistic system can be beneficial, but we can't just dismiss basic organic growing principles as,
that's right,
as outdated.
Right. Yeah, unfortunately, organic, and I think Aaron alluded to this early on, it's become so problematic, and I totally know what you mean by organic. And but, when we brought these doctors down to the farm school at Piscinas Ranch, we actually brought them to a lab at the farm school, which was two fields side by side. One of the fields is organic carrots being grown for a large organic company here in California, a production company that sells all over the U.S. And on the other side was mixed cropping of a bunch of different legumes and grains that is also a field where they're growing a produce for humans, but that part of the year also has a livestock that rotate through it and that is actually not certified organic, but that, and does allow rotational grazing. And what we discovered as we did this work in the lab was that, in fact, this organic carrot field was using twice as much water, that the soil health was much inferior to the other field, and that much of the year it was fallow because, once the carrot crop was gone, because carrots are a root, you can't leave a living root once you harvest the carrot, there was nothing in that field for, 6 to 9 months a year. And it's just, there was a lot of soil erosion. It had very low health score versus this, rotational field, which actually per acre was yielding, more nutrition if you looked at it in a year-round basis, plus the animal protein that was coming out of there, using half as much water and requiring no external fertility at all because the animals were supplying the fertility. So that was eye-opening for these doctors who just had been walking around saying organic, organic, organic,
It's the beyond organic.
Yeah, the subtleties of, once you actually get people out into the, production acreage in this country, the subtleties are really what make the difference. And those are, those are difficult discussions to have because, in fact, organic, as we are now practicing it, might not be the sustainable answer at all.
Yeah. It is a bit as, being the only alternative to conventional organic and big box organic has definitely become a way of integrating something into the current conventional agricultural system as the alternative. What I'm enthused by, and I'm sure definitely you see it too, because in the Bay Area, it's a hotbed for this, is the innovation economy, is the enthusiasm, the excitement around regenerative agriculture, in looking at these better approaches, that management matters greatly. And in the long horizon, it's better for the land, it's better for the economics, it's better for human health and planetary health. And the systems thinking approach, starting from the farm, seems to be immersive. And I'll go back to a point you made earlier of your research internationally. Well, we have some great models to look at internationally as well that allow us to know that both through empirical evidence and statistical data, that these systems do work better. And over a longer period of time, even with an assessment of a horizon of a decade, boy, you can see a vast and drastic difference.
Yeah, no, I mean, there is a fair amount of data to support this. I totally agree. And in, you know, small to medium-sized farms around the world that are shifting back to really what was a more traditional form of sustainable farming,
yeah.
You know, before the Green Revolution came in, they're showing an increase in decrease in soil erosion, increase in productivity. I mean, they haven't necessarily studied the nutrient value of the plants that are coming off of these systems. But, you know, all of the little studies that I've seen actually show that there is an increase in nutrient value as a result of improving soil health. But that's something that we actually still need to establish.
In your bio, it mentions Dr. Miller welcomes the challenge of the medical mysteries and enjoys helping patients tackle complex and vexing health problems. But she feels her most important role is to help patients discover their inner doctor so that they may develop the skills they need to manage their own health. So the question I have for you out of that is, you sit in a Petri dish in the Bay Area. We're here in the Boston area, New York area, a bit of a Petri dish as well. How do we get more individuals here in these Petri dishes, but more as a collective that are less of the elite or folks that are less endowed with this information about regenerative or connection with soil health and their health and environmental health? How do we get more people involved in this? How do we change socioeconomic or cross-economic, socioeconomic barriers to say, boy, if you're going to invest in yourself and if you want to put some money into something that's going to be better for your health and family's health, good food's the way to do it. This is actually a very inexpensive way of taking care of yourself. Have you found anything to be successful in that approach?
Yeah, I mean, having communities actually start to share this information amongst themselves. I mean, that it's way more powerful when it comes from your neighbors and people you respect or your local doctors or your local podcast star or whatever. I think what you're doing is great, Aaron, and we need an Aaron in every neighborhood, you know, who's kind of sharing this information with their neighbors. I have found that community gardens, they might not grow enough nutrition for that geographic area, but they tend to act as this amazing spark for raising awareness, just because they're this beautiful aesthetic thing that draws people out of their house and gets them talking to each other about all kinds of health and sustainability. So I actually think that they're a wonderful vector for health. And there's a researcher in Colorado, Jill Litt, a public health researcher that really is looking at the health impacts of community gardening as in a very holistic way, you know, everything, not just the exercise or the sunshine or the nutrients from the food, but really how it changes the health of a community. I also think that using our institutions in this country as a way of both communicating this information, but also changing policy are very, very important. So, you know, there is starting to be a healthy food and hospital trend, but what would it be like if all the other hospitals who haven't signed on all of a sudden committed to buying only, you know, local sustainably grown food, or better yet, started to have, you know, little farms instead of glyphosate-covered lawns on their hospitals? What would it be like if every elder home or nursing home in this country and the Meals on Wheels program committed to only getting locally sustainably sourced food? What would it be like if we truly changed our school lunch program and just didn't just add a couple pennies to it per child per day, but actually, you know, really made it a health-giving program? You know, all of these pieces added together would be massive. And I do feel like they would, in fact, in the end, change what we are growing. Because right now, if every American actually even met the minimal USDA guidelines in terms of, you know, three to four servings of fruits and vegetables a day, we'd suddenly realize that we are growing things completely wrong in this country, because we would not be able to meet the demand for that. We are underproducing fruits and vegetables.
One other addition to the institutional thing that I was just thinking about as you were talking is, you know, how do we not only just leverage the healthcare industry and the ag industry and others, but the religious community? When you think about, you know, where do people get their advice and their guidance for kind of a lot of things in life, right? You go to your doctor and you go to your religious leader first for many people. And I'm thinking, you know, the urban coastal communities and then everything in the middle in the heartland where I grew up, you know, religion is everything.
Yeah.
And so, and a lot of religious organizations own a lot of farmland. There was just a great story that I was reading about a pastor who was really tired of burying so many people, losing parishioners in his community to diet-related diseases, that he started a community garden program and a farming program and a youth engagement program and trying to teach his parishioners how to eat better because they're getting larger and larger and dying of diet-related disease, and taking it into his own hand. And I'm just wondering, as you're rattling off all the other institutional collaborators in this, if we could get the religious community to weigh in and help
Absolutely.
Educate people.
I think that's an absolutely fantastic idea. I was contacted the other day by someone who owns golf courses, who is sort of asking me, can you help me do the math on what would happen if I started to transition my golf courses to areas of food production? I was like, this
wow.
is the coolest project. I'm totally up for working with you on this. If you think of the amount of acreage in this country that's covered by golf courses.
Yeah. It's, I think to the point of the religious, making the pasture more pastoral, right?
Right.
There you go. Or education, too. I mean, in school-age education, K-12, the lack of knowledge of understanding of eating, making that accessible, not just in the school, but if we can get our kids and teach, if we have curriculum in school to teach our kids, they become our best advocates for teaching adults how to eat better. If they're the ones that are walking through and inspiring their folks to look at things differently in the food system. And maybe that connection point, as we spoke to before, is environmental impact. Knowing that your choices matter in the stability of the planet could be impetus to get young folks involved in the food movement for other reasons that they may not materialize in their own health. So Dr. Miller, if you could share with our audience where they can learn more about your books, about the programs you're working on, and about your practice. Do you have a website that would be the best location to find this?
Yeah, it's a little shaky at this moment. It's sort of in transition, but the website is Dr. Daphne, drdaphne.com. And the book that probably is most relevant to this conversation is Pharmacology, but with an F instead of a PH.
I'll include I'll include links at the bottom of the write-up on the page, and then in our iTunes account. And regarding the Pharmacology book, and most of our listeners know who Michael Pollan is, and he had some nice praise for it. He says, "What does the practice of sustainable agriculture have to do with teaching modern medicine? What are the links between soil health and the health of people who eat from that soil? A highly original and compelling work of exploring the large implications for our understanding of health," is what Michael Pollan said about Dr. Daphne Miller's book, Pharmacology. So we'll include a link for you on that. And we absolutely look forward to seeing what comes out next, to hear more about your symposiums. And Jennifer, final thoughts from you?
I just say congratulations for being so visionary and shepherding these great conversations. I think it is more important than ever that we connect system-wide dots among all these many different systems that we've talked about today. So I look forward to staying in touch and to seeing where this conversation goes. Thank you.
Absolutely. No, I actually learned a lot today, so it's good for me. I've been taking notes the whole time.
So have I. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for partaking in the conversation. We look forward to chatting again.
All right. Be well, both of you, and thank you so much.
Thank you.
Great. Take care.